I'm here with three members, organizers, and players of the series at the Ladies Library of Kalamazoo, featuring the Arcadia Winds and Friends, almost always with Friends, and here to talk about a concert of wind plus music on Friday night is Ron Chase, a horn player and a lead organizer, you might say, guest pianist Barbara Hong, and from the Ladies Library Association itself, Paula Jameson. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Ron, would you go into Friday's concert a little bit, an overview?
Sure. Yes. This is the fourth of four concerts that the Ladies Library is sponsoring. The Arcadia Woodwind Quintet will not be a quintet for this particular concert. They will be mixed in with a group of very, very fine local musicians, 17 in total by the time the concert is finished. The first half of the concert will be small ensembles. The first piece is going to be one of Haydn's London trios and be played by flute, cello, and piano. The second one is Gabriel Fauré's Siciliana, which will be flute and piano. And then the third one is the first movement of a trio by Robert Kahn, which will be for clarinet, cello, and piano. The second half of the concert is the Serenade No. 2 by Johannes Brahms. And this is really kind of exciting, I think. We are going to have 15 musicians and one conductor playing the original score of Brahms. This is not going to be any kind of reduction or anything like that. It's as Brahms wrote it and as it is normally performed. The only difference that we have going here is that we will have less than the usual number of strings. There's a limited space that we can create on the stage of the Ladies' Library, so therefore the strings will be somewhat limited, but the winds will all be as Brahms intended. Strings will just have to play a little louder than usual. So that's the program, essentially. We're looking forward to it. I think it's going to be very exciting.
When was the previous concert? How many weeks ago would you say?
The previous concert was on the 17th, I believe, of March. So about 2 months ago.
And this music has been working up since then. I imagine the Brahms has gotten the focus of most of people's attention.
Well, not necessarily. The Brahms has to be practiced, obviously, in a fairly large place. So we've been practicing the Brahms in the Ladies' Library itself. And so, therefore, that's been kind of the focus of rehearsal space. For the smaller compositions, they can be done in people's homes. And Barbara has a very nice studio, and so they can work there for that one. So I'm not really sure in the balance who has worked the hardest. I think it's probably been about even.
Well, it seems to be the case in many great composers' works, the flute has been left out of the serenade by Brahms. So I see you've kind of compensated for that lack of a major woodwind by inviting a wonderful flutist, Christine Griffiths, to join the program.
Yes. Yes, she is going to have a very big part in the program, as a matter of fact. She's the flutist on the Haydn. She is the soloist, essentially, with Barbara's accompaniment on the foray, and she is playing first flute and piccolo in the Brahms Serenade.
What? So, oh, I thought this was without flutes.
No, there's two flutes.
Oh, well, I wish I could rewind and get that right. I'm sorry. I thought I was ready to go get grumpy again about no flutes. That's Dvorak, isn't it, in his Wind Serenade?
Correct, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, then. Well, lucky Christine. tell me, she's principal flute in the Kalamazoo Philharmonia.
Correct.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
Do you also play in the Philharmonia?
I do, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're preparing some Bartok for...
Yes, it's a absolutely incredible piece of music. Just totally surprising because Bartok wrote it relatively early in his composing career, and it's very, very... advanced for that particular time frame. The Bluebeard's Castle is what we're doing. It's about an hour long, and it's a kind of what you might call a concert opera, with a soprano and bass and full orchestra.
Oh my.
So. And then the other piece on it is the Nocturnes by Debussy, which is always a wonderful composition, including the women's choir, as a matter of fact.
Well, thank you for that quick preview of the Philharmonia concert, which is still a few weeks away.
It'll be the next night after the concert we're talking about here. It's going to be on the 20th.
It's already this weekend?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Andrew Kohler has been a very busy man. So, I'm glad we got a chance to pitch that as well, although I think Andrew may be coming in later this week to talk about Bluebeard's Castle. But let's get back to Friday night and the Ladies' Library. Paula, you've always been so gracious to accompany the musicians and tell listeners about the facilities and the hall in which the music takes place.
The Ladies' Library is downtown on Park Street, and it's a building that was built in 1878, 1879, and it was built by a women's organization, the first building in the U.S. to have been financed and constructed by a group of women, which was pretty radical in those days. And when they built it, they built space for a library downstairs, a membership library, and upstairs they built an auditorium with a stage. And that's where the concerts occur, of course. And it's a lovely little hall. We seat about 80 in the audience, and the stage just fits the people that Ron is bringing with him for this week. But the hall will be filled with glorious sound, I'm sure, with this group. It should be quite lovely.
Since we've had a similar conversation many times before about how the hall and its history, I'm trying to think of new questions. So is it haunted?
Oh, actually, that's an interesting question. A lot of people have been asking that lately. We've had a lot of tours lately. No, it's not haunted, as far as we can tell. When the building was upgraded a few years ago and we put in an elevator, one of the things that happened, the hall had been carpeted in this very thick, pale green carpeting, not just the floor of the seating area, but also the stage. And musicians who came to play said it was like playing in a shoebox stuffed full of cotton. The acoustics were just totally dead.
Oh, yeah.
So when we started pulling out the carpeting, one of the things we discovered was the floor squeaked horrifically. And so we had most of those terrible squeaks taken out.
How do you track down a squeak?
You step on it.
And then you just hammer the...
And, well, our contractor magicians came in, pulled up the floorboards, and apparently you put screws in to the joists at a certain angle, and it kind of helps take away the word. I mean, we still have a few squeaks, but I think that may have been one of the things that gave rise to the haunted sort of mythology of the place.
So you do give lots of tours.
Yes, we do.
And what are some of the parts of the tour?
Well, we take people, there are a lot of historic pieces of art, and tell the story of the library. We still have a lot of the old 19th century volumes on display, and just talk about the role of the organization back in the history of the community, because we started actually in 1844 and became kind of officially incorporated in 1852. So we're a longstanding organization, and we had quite a bit of a role back in the early days when Kalamazoo was still Bronson Village, and you know, we were a force. Our sort of foremothers were a real force for preserving culture and transmitting culture, and also doing kind of what they used to call good works in the community. So we've got a long and venerable history, and a lot of people enjoy seeing the building.
Let's get back to Friday night's program. Music begins at 7:30 p.m. It's free and open to the public. A suggested donation is not required, but suggested, and there's a way to donate as you walk into the room, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me, Ron, about the first piece on the program? It's this trio by Franz Josef Haydn.
Can I defer to Barbara on that one?
Why, yes.
So she's one of the performers.
Well, that's a great idea. Barbara Hong.
Well, the Haydn is an unusual piece in that it is a trio, yes, but it is really a piano sonata accompanied by flute and cello. And I don't think we hear this kind of piece much anymore. When we think of trios, we think of three equal partners contributing, and that's not the case here. So I was curious about this, and I went and looked up a little bit of background and found that this comes originally from the Baroque trio sonata, where you have two melody instruments and you have a continuo. You have the harpsichord player who plays the bass line and a cello player who plays the bass line. And the keyboard player is told, fill in some chords here and there, anything you like that goes with the chords. And as time went on, composers wanted to have more control over what the keyboard player was doing. So the keyboard part became a little more fixed and a little bit fuller. And from that point on, they realized that the keyboard player could actually be one of those melody players. So it developed into a predominantly keyboard melody, with the other players being a little bit more subordinated. So it's kind of surprising to find that composers who wrote piano sonatas at this time very often submitted their work to a publisher, and the publisher would go and get some hack to write a violin part to accompany it because it was expected. And nowadays, that's kind of shocking to us to think of such a thing. So this particular piece by Haydn is sort of the last bit of this kind of piano-dominated trio sonata. So you actually, as I'm playing this, I realize my right hand is busy, 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 and the left hand is not doing much. So it's really a melody part, and the flute player actually takes a place of a violinist. So this piece can be played by a flute or violin, but originally was designed for flute. The flute player duplicates and sometimes alternates with the keyboard, but really never has a starring role.
Material of its own. Yeah.
And from what I understand, the reason why this was an accompanied kind of thing is because the pianoforte at that time was a rather quiet instrument, and they felt it needed to be augmented,
boosted
by something.
Up a little.
Yeah. So, and this particular trio was written around 1790, and Mozart was writing piano trios in the 1780s that were really trios, equal part trios. But Haydn is sort of the last one to write this kind of part. So the work itself is a very cheerful D major piece, and it's full of Haydn's usual musical jokes. Some things that could be pointed out: there's a place where, you know, the melody is running up and down with scales and arpeggios and so forth, and then you suddenly come to a halt and nothing happens for a whole measure, and you think, what's going on here? What's wrong? And then the musicians start again in another key. It's almost like, oh, we made a mistake. We need to switch and be in the right key here. And so they're off on a brand new key. In other places, there are a building, a crescendo of some little motive that builds and builds and builds, and then you have a quiet little echo at the end, like someone in the corner over there had to have a last word in. So it's quite pleasant work to listen to. Cheerful.
Haydn is so good for people to who think classical music is really serious. If just have a Haydn diet for a month or so, and you know, it's full of little jokes like that.
Yes.
Well, let's take a break and hear some of the music from the Haydn Trio in D, number 16. It's what starts the program on Friday at 7:30 p.m. at the Ladies Library Richmond Auditorium with Christine Griffith on flute, Elizabeth Euchre on cello, and Barbara Hong at the piano. Heard the first movement of the Haydn Trio in D major, number 16, in a different version than we had prepared for our listeners. We were expecting to hear a bit of flute music along with that. In Haydn's day, publishers would cash in any way they possibly could. So there were violin versions, flute versions. Is that right, Barbara?
Yes.
So, which it might be really interesting to read a good book on the publishing, the music publishing business of the late 18th, early 19th centuries. Quite a lot of shenanigans.
Shenanigans, yes, yes. A lot of arguments, yes.
And as you said, composers were still echoing a Baroque idea of a trio sonata, which in that era meant a dominant keyboard. And so you write a keyboard sonata, add a few parts, which, as you call them, subordinate parts, and you get to sell it three times.
Right, right.
So
and maybe in different countries too.
Absolutely.
Because it's not the copyrights and so forth were not.
Cross a border, and
yes.
You're good to go all over again.
Yes.
Yeah. Without the composer knowing any the wiser. Being any the wiser. So the program begins on Friday at 7:30 p.m. with this lovely trio, which will be performed in full. How many movements are there, Barbara?
Three movements.
Movements. Classic scheme of fast, slow, fast.
Yes.
Okay. And again, your fellow musicians for this trio?
Are Christine Griffith, flute, and Liz Euchre, cello.
We could talk a little about Liz Euchre, who I know as an administrator, and I don't think I had a chance to hear her play cello
She
before.
Has for some time been a participant in our Ensemble des Amis trio, and then along came a couple of small children, and she took a little time out there. But she's interested in being back in, and we're delighted to have her back.
That is fantastic. I mean, and she's also established.
She's a fine cellist.
Yeah,
yes.
She also established Kalamazoo Kids in Tune,
yes.
Which is celebrating 6 years in next month with a celebration. And Liz, will she perform again later in the program? I believe
she's involved in the Brahms.
Okay, very
yes.
good.
Yes.
Well, before we get to the foray, I wanted to get back to Paula Jameson and ask about some of the other activities at the Ladies Library of Kalamazoo.
Yes, we were talking about tours a little bit earlier, and for the second year, the Ladies Library is going to be a featured site on the Kalamazoo Historic Commission's Hidden Kalamazoo Tour. And this is in about a month. It's the 17th and 18th of June. That's Father's Day weekend. And tickets can be purchased that give you access to, I believe there are 9 different sites this year. And the idea of the tour is to get people into buildings that they might not normally have access to. Sometimes it will be the upstairs of a building where there's a storefront downtown. And the tours are quite fascinating. They're self-guided. You get your ticket and you can go and you can get your ticket punched. At each site, there are docents, though, that take you around. It's a great window into Kalamazoo history. Last year, the weekend was quite hot. And of course, people were very pleased to walk into our air-conditioned building. And we had about 500 people go through the building over the course of the weekend. So it's a great way to see parts of the city. You can see as few or as many of the 9 sites as you care to. Your ticket gets you in on both Saturday and Sunday. And they can be purchased, I believe, at City Hall and several other venues around town. So it's a fun event, and it's the big fundraiser for the Kalamazoo Historic Commission.
This must be attractive mostly to Kalamazoo residents.
I think so. I mean, you get people that come in from, in the county and things too. But it's a wonderful event if you're interested at all in local history too. So
I hosted family over the weekend from out of town. And boy, the questions that you get that you can't answer can be real posers. So
that's certainly true. All the things you realize you don't know.
So. Well, again, this live concert is Friday at 7:30 p.m. in the Lighty's Library Richmond Auditorium, which is upstairs, accessible by stairs or an elevator. And the program continues with a lovely song for flute and piano called Sicilienne. And it's by French composer Gabriel Fauré. Barbara Hong, maybe you can describe it a little more.
Okay. Fauré was a late 19th century musician in France. He was an organist, and he played at the Church of the Madeleine and at Saint Sulpice in Paris, which are two of the top places to play, other than Notre Dame. He was a fine organist. He also was a composer. And he eventually became the director of the Paris Conservatory. He was a composition teacher, and many of the French composers that we know studied with him. So he had a very high status in Paris and France at that time. Maybe we don't hear so much of him now, but at that time he was quite a prominent person, influential. The Sicilian, I believe, comes originally from a dance from Sicily. Can't tell you much more about that, except that I know it's in 6-8. This particular piece was composed as a part of incidental music to a play which never was performed on the topic of Melisande. There's another opera by, I think it's Debussy on Melisande. And when I think about this particular piece, it is a very lilting, very wistful, full of longing maybe. And it perfectly fits the subject of Melisande. Melisande, as far as I remember, was a mysterious woman found in the woods, and a prince married her and never could quite figure out what she was all about. And maybe the whole opera is his wanting her to be what he needed, and she was not quite within reach. So this piece is beautiful, wistful. It's originally for cello, but has been arranged for many separate solo instruments. It does comes off beautifully for flute.
Let's hear it in a recording from the Naxos label. I'm with Barbara Hong, Ron Chase, and Paula Jameson previewing Friday night's concert by the Arcadia Chamber Players and Friends.
Thank you.
Well, we did hear the right piece after a quick quick switch, and it was certainly worth that 3 minutes of music. Really, really beautiful melody. And so famous. You were saying, Barbara, that Fauré's pieces, his full output maybe not heard a lot, but there are certain pieces of his that are still really regularly played.
Yes.
Yeah. This is a third, a second on the program after the Haydn Trio. We hear a little flute interlude with Christine Griffith and yourself, Barbara Hong. How does the program continue?
We go on from there to a clarinet, cello, and piano trio by Robert Kahn. He's not well known, but he was born around the 1880s, I believe, or maybe a little earlier, in Germany. He was from a Jewish family that was full of intellectuals, professional people. He got musical training. He ended up being a composition teacher at the Berlin Hochschule for Music, which was one of the top conservatories for music in Germany. And he mainly wrote chamber music. He was a concert pianist, so well known that way. In 1934, the Nazis came in, and all Jews lost their jobs, including Robert Kahn. And he did not manage to get out of Germany until 1939. And we just wonder what happened to him, what he went through in those, 5 years. Mm-hmm. He eventually managed to get to England in 39 and continued composing, even though he was by that time already in his 70s. He did meet Brahms. Brahms invited him to be his student, and he felt a little shy of Brahms. So the style is late Romantic. It's very melodic. It's very chromatic. It's very beautiful, and the interweaving of the three performances is very intricate, very nice. Just when I think, oh, someone has the melody, then the other person takes it over, and it's the motives are thrown back and forth. It's a lovely work. The trio itself has three movements, and it's quite long. We hope maybe we can do it in the fall. It's about 32 minutes long, but well worth doing. So Robert Kahn really deserves an audience. It's a wonderful piece.
So interesting to hear about his background, living a little outside of the time period in which his music was popular, mm-hmm. as a sort of a protege of Brahms. Well, who died must have been 1896, I think.
Yes.
So Kahn was still quite young.
Yes.
At that time, and he stayed with that late Romantic style. So that may be why we don't hear as much Kahn as had, right. if he'd come right. along during the heyday.
Right. And also, there are some composers that we don't hear of much because they didn't get the public attention by writing symphonies and operas. If you wanted to be a known composer, a success, you had to write in those forms. And this is something that Kahn didn't do.
Well, maybe we'll hear a little from Ron about next season's plans, if you have any to announce at this time, or any hints you can give about next season with Arcadia Winds.
The coming season, we are certainly hoping to have four more concerts at the Ladies' Library. And we always meet in August, probably in early August, and plan a year-long repertoire. So we can say that the quintet is very enthusiastic about continuing these concerts, and we can't say yet, you know, exactly what we're going to play. We have a couple things in mind right now, but we're not ready to announce a full program yet.
And Paula, would you, at the end of the hour, again, remind people where the Ladies' Library is and how to find parking, and then we'll go back and finish up with the Brahms.
All right. The Ladies Library is on South Park Street, 333 South Park. We are just south of the Kalamazoo Civic Building, a red brick building sort of tucked behind this Kalamazoo Civic. We have our designated parking lot, which is on the south side of Lovell Street, across the street from the Civic lot that's immediately next door to us, free parking. And, of course, in the evenings, parking is on the street. If you can get it, is also available. So we're very, very happy to welcome the public to these concerts. And we always sponsor a little reception afterwards where you're welcome to join the musicians for tea and cookies and other goodies. So we hope to see you.
Now, joining the Ladies Library is kind of a big decision. It involves a financial contribution or a
If you were to join, we have about, I think we have 167 members. It is a women's organization. And actually, our dues are quite reasonable. It's $50 to join per year. And there are a lot of different volunteer opportunities. We favor literacy. We favor general culture and keeping the building open to the public.
I was just going to ask if you felt it was worth your membership fee to be part of the Ladies Library?
Oh, I think absolutely it is. And of course, like any organization, we have people who are more or less active and people's lives change. So like you were saying about Christine Euchre, I mean, things happen and so you're not so involved and then all of a sudden you're back. And so we have, you know, we have people whose involvement waxes and wanes over the years.
Well, for this final performance in the concert on Friday night, you're bringing together 15 players.
Plus a conductor.
And a conductor. Yeah. That's why I slid the program guide over to you, Ron, because I want you to acknowledge all the people in the program and thought that might give you some help in naming all the musicians.
Okay.
Our listeners will probably know many of them.
Okay, I could probably do that without notes.
Okay,
just, you know, just when you get safety. So involved in something, you just sort of absorb it.
Okay, let's
yes,
see you do it.
In terms of winds, our two flutes, our first is Christine Griffith, number two is Bobby Coleman. Oboes, number one is Katie Durham, and number two is Holly Tracy. On clarinets, number one is Mike Petkus, and number two is Marcia Working. Bassoons, one is Christine Kvarnberg, and number two is Anne-Marie Walton. On horns, number one is Ron Chase, and number two is Jan Solberg, and that takes care of the winds. We have two really wonderful violas. We have Sherry Sima, and we have Tomio Anderson. On cello, we have Liz Euchre and Mary Butler, and our bassist is Dave Riley. The conductor is the very, very wonderful timpanist from the Philharmonia Orchestra, Dave King.
Oh, terrific. So you have a conductor for the first
time.
We
have a conductor, yes. We realized in one of our very early rehearsals that Brahms is just a little bit too intricate for 15 people and no conductor.
Well, any final thoughts on the concert Friday night?
It's going to be a little bit of an unusual concert to have kind of a what you might call a small chamber first half and a very large chamber second half. I think that's going to be a wonderful contrast. And the Brahms is a youthful piece. It's Opus 16. He wrote it relatively early in his career. And he supposedly wrote it as a what you might call a student piece. He was very concerned about his ability to create large symphonic works. So he figured he needed a couple of trials before he really got on it. And supposedly the Second Serenade is one of his trials. But it is certainly a very, very mature composition. And as far as I'm concerned, it's as good a Brahms as any.
As a horn player, that's saying something. Well, thank you, Ron, thank you, Barbara, and thank you, Paula, for coming in to preview Friday night's concert.